The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello, my time travelling friends. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, and welcome to another extra special episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now, today we are going to be focusing on one of the most successful and popular monarchs in English history. I am, of course, talking about Elizabeth I. And in fact, we're going to be looking specifically at how Elizabeth used portraiture and miniatures to portray her image and her royal authority. And to help us explore this particular topic, I'm going to be joined today by historian and author Siobhan Clark. Along with her co-author Linda Collins, they have written a book called Gloriana, Elizabeth I and the Art of Queenship, which was released on the 16th of June here in the UK. Well, image, portraits, well, they're right up my alleyway. And I am fascinated by the cult of the Virgin Queen. So I was delighted to be able to link up with Siobhan on Zoom and explore this topic with her in more detail. Well, my friends, there's no housekeeping for this particular extra special episode, and so we can get straight on with the show. So hello, Siobhan. Welcome back to the Tudor History and Travel Show.
Hello, Sarah, and it's lovely to be back again. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're most welcome. I was having a little bit of a chat to you before we started recording and saying, my, you have been busy, because it didn't seem that long ago since we were talking about your last book, King and Collector. And here we are with another book. You are a very busy person, Siobhan.
Yes, and I was explaining to you that it really is partly because of the pandemic and being at home, having the time to just focus on writing, not being able to go out and do take tours at Hampton Court Palace. And also because there's two of us working on it, obviously, we're sharing the work. And we both had the time to really concentrate. And it's been great, actually, really pleased. And we wrote it quite quickly and got it produced soon after King and Collector.
Concentrated time to work. Now, there's a rare thing. It's amazing what you can get done, isn't it, when there aren't numerous distractions going on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, obviously, I mentioned you've been on the show before. We've just mentioned that. We've just talked a little bit about that. But there may be people tuning in for the first time who haven't caught that episode. So it'd be really great if you could just introduce yourself and tell us about your background and why you're interested in this particular subject matter.
Yeah, so I've been at historical palaces for 20 years. I also lecture for various organisations. And with my colleague, Linda Collins, we both appeared on Secrets of Henry VIII's Palace a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And she also worked for HRP. And with using that experience, and as decades really of working there, we wrote and published King and Collector in 2021, which was looking at Henry VIII's art collection and really looking at his life through his art. Mm. We thought it would be an interesting thing to do. Linda's an art historian. And then following up from that, it was actually Alison Weir who suggested that we then do something on Elizabeth using the same format, using the paintings as a gateway. And our publishers liked the idea. So it all happened really quite quickly, really, with this follow-up.
Well, it is a really interesting angle. I'm used to looking at the lives of great Tudor characters through places, but looking at them through their art is absolutely fascinating. I really enjoyed our previous conversation. So I would urge anybody listening who hasn't tuned in to the previous episode to make sure you do so. And I'll put a link in the description so that you can easily locate that episode, dear listeners. But for the time being, we're talking about the current book, and I did introduce it in my introduction. It's called Gloriana, Elizabeth I and the Art of Queenship. And maybe you can tell us in a nutshell, Siobhan, what's it all about? What question in particular does it aim to answer?
It's just really giving an overview of Elizabeth. And of course, her biography has been done countless times before, but we're doing it through her portrait. So biography using art as a gateway to understand Elizabeth and her image. We're putting the portraits in the context of her life. And we're also digging a little deeper into the cult of Gloriana, and looking at actually not just paintings, but also having a little look at literature and music and the Golden Age, because that's all wrapped up in the whole thing of Gloriana and her image.
I'm really looking forward to exploring that because I find this whole image of the Virgin Queen and how it came about to be particularly interesting. And I'm not sure I've yet had a completely satisfactory answer as to how and when it emerged and who was the brainchild behind it. So I look forward to exploring that a little bit more with you in a moment. But I'm also always interested to find out what kind of research you had to do for a book like this. Did you get into all sorts of nooks and crannies, get to see great pieces of art? What did you do, Siobhan? Tell us.
Well, we read everything possible that we could get our hands on, primary and secondary sources, looked at the most important portraits of Elizabeth, and it's about picking out these iconic, because obviously we can't cover everything. So we had to pick out the most, what we felt were the most important, and then research each work, mindful of how each work would tell some aspect of her story. And then the research led us into a wider exploration of the Golden Age, as I mentioned earlier, and also having a look at some of the courtiers surrounding her and how they used art as well.
It must have been difficult to choose some of the most important ones, to quote you there, because there are so many images of Elizabeth, aren't there? How did you manage to wheedle them down?
Well, there are certain ones that you just can't leave out. You know, you have to put in the Darnley portrait, the Armada, the Ditchley portrait, the Phoenix, the Pelican, portrait of Elizabeth as a princess. So there are portraits that just really stand out that people would be surprised if they weren't there. But one of the, you asked me earlier about when we were doing the research, were there any surprises? I can't really say that I was surprised about Elizabeth, perhaps because I'd done so much research about her anyway. Mm. So, but one of the things that surprised me actually was about Robert Dudley, because I didn't realise that he was such an ardent patron and that he was the greatest collector in England, that, you know, he owned 200 paintings and collected paintings of foreign princes. So, for example, Catherine de' Medici sent him a portrait of her son, the Duke of Anjou, who would later become his rival. He had pictures of all his family, and interestingly, not his executed forebears, but people like Sir Philip Sidney, his nephew. And he set a trend amongst courtiers to have references to themselves in their pictures of the Queen. And so this is quite important, because you often see Elizabeth holding a fan or some kind of accessory. And these accessories are usually gifted to her by the patron. So therefore, those in the know would understand, when they look at the painting, they would be able to understand the relationship between the patron and the Queen. So he started that trend. What I found quite amusing was that the most frequent subject of Leicester's commissions was himself. You expect that he commissioned a lot of Elizabeth, but he commissioned at least 20 of himself, which was so unusual. Even among foreign rulers, you know, they didn't usually have that many paintings. So he was also very interested in his image and how it could be used, you know, to further his cause to marry the Queen. And he also did really cheeky things like commission portraits of them both to be hung side by side as if they were a couple, which I think is quite funny.
It is quite funny, isn't it? I remember coming across that a little bit where I think I was speaking to Professor Sue Doran and we were talking about some of the art at Kenilworth Castle. So I imagine a lot of those 200 paintings that you mentioned would have adorned the walls at Kenilworth. And that particular pair, there was a particular pair of paintings, I think, that he had commissioned for Elizabeth's visit. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah. And hung together, as I said, as if they were a couple. So a really cheeky yes. thing. And then of course it also gave him the opportunity to show off his fine clothing in the paintings and his physique, and you know, as I say, further his cause to be a suitable candidate for the Queen's hand.
He really did everything he could, didn't he? To no avail, of course. But anyway, let's focus our attention on Elizabeth, and because she seemed to me to be a woman who knew how to marshal her image and the importance of image and propaganda. But I've often wondered where that came from, where that sort of nous to do that came from. What do you think? Where do you think that originated for, or how did it originate for Elizabeth?
So she had the examples of both her father and her grandfather, Henry VII, which is, again, maybe a little bit surprising. But then when you dig down, you find that Henry VII, although well known as a miser, he spent a lot of money on clothes after he became king. And he knew that royal image making, you know, was vital. So he was prepared to pay for tapestries and fine palaces. He would use artists, poets and historians to project himself as the legitimate king of England. So image making was vital, and he really understood that the illusion of power and wealth was a necessary ingredient, really. And so therefore he was prepared to spend. And then his son, Henry VIII, Elizabeth's father, spends even more money on the most magnificent court that England had ever seen, with the palaces, the tapestries, the art, because he's a rival to European rulers. And with his patronage, he will bring European artists into England. The Renaissance really sort of properly arrives. And then he has the genius, Hans Holbein, who creates that image of Henry, you know, the ultimate royal image making. So she didn't have to look very far for examples of royal image making.
And do you think that the Tudors were the first kind of royal house that had all of these things come together at once, which almost made it a perfect sort of breeding ground for creating royal propaganda through portraiture? Would that be fair to say?
I think so, because of the Renaissance arriving, because of Holbein, Henry VIII bringing in these really talented people. Previous medieval kings hadn't really used art like that before. You know, they commissioned paintings for diplomatic reasons, such as marriage treaties, that kind of thing. Artists were not highly regarded. They were treated as artisans. Even in the reign of Henry VIII, they're still not terribly well paid. I mean, Hans Holbein, famously, he only earned £30 a year. Mm-hmm. But they are starting to get more recognition and becoming popular, not just with the royal family, but with the nobility. And hence we have all these wonderful paintings that are left to us of Hans Holbein is able to show us the Tudor court.
Aren't we lucky? So you talked before, Siobhan, about some of the symbols. We started to touch on those. And there are so many symbols in Tudor art. And I love being able to try and make sense of them. Sometimes not very successfully, I have to say. But maybe you could talk to us about some of the more common symbols that we see associated with Elizabeth, so that if anybody wants to stand in front of a piece of art that depicts Elizabeth, they might be able to pick out some new things and make some sense of what they're seeing.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, the most obvious and the clearest symbol is very simple: pearls. You always see Elizabeth wearing pearls. They symbolise chastity. they connect her to Cynthia, who was a Greek goddess of the moon, who was a virgin. And this idea is also promoted through literature. To give you an example, Sir Walter Raleigh published a long poem that he wrote in the 1580s, The Ocean's Love to Cynthia. And in that, he compares Elizabeth to the moon, to this moon goddess. Elizabeth was also associated with Minerva, the classic virgin goddess of war. Minerva appears a lot in both Tudor and Stuart propaganda, because she's someone who depicts purity and wisdom, but she's also a fighter, a fighter for just causes. Although it's important to say that Elizabeth, although prepared for war, she always preferred peace. And you will sometimes see olive branches in her paintings, in the works, which symbolise peace. Another important symbol is the sieve, or sieve, symbol of virginity and purity. And that goes back to Roman times. And there was a whole series of portraits on Elizabeth, the sieve portraits, which celebrate her virginity. And they allude to Elizabeth as a Roman Vestal Virgin. And then flowers and fruit, if you see them, that represents youth and fertility. That's particularly evident in the Hampden portrait, which when Elizabeth was still quite young, and it was painted to really for the European marriage market. And then if you see the crown and sceptre, clearly they're indicating monarchy and the body and the body politic, so as opposed to her human body. And then the globe represents imperial ambitions. You might sometimes see the sword of state for justice. Sometimes you see bright skies and storm clouds, particularly in the Armada portrait. And that represents, of course, famously, you know, the Armada were wrecked by storms. But also, it also appears in the Ditchley portrait. The bright skies, meaning Elizabeth bringing light, and storm clouds, meaning that, you know, the queen can control, almost she can control nature. And in the Ditchley portrait, there's a caption that says she gives but does not expect, she can but does not take revenge. So it's alluding to this sort of aspect of the queen. Where you see black and white, and she often does pose in wearing black and white, those are the colours of chastity and constancy. The Tudor rose obviously refers to the Tudor dynasty, but the rose also has religious connotations. It was the medieval symbol of the Virgin Mary.
Wow.
Yeah, and then you might see jewels like the pelican, favourite jewel, used to portray her motherly love for her subjects, or the phoenix, the mythological bird, which resurrects. It's a symbol of endurance and eternal life. It's also a symbol of her uniqueness, because only one phoenix can live at a time. Then there's the ermine, of course, which is a status symbol restricted to royalty and higher nobility. But again, purity keeps coming up again and again, because the ermine was also very pure. And there was a legend that said it would rather die than soil its pure white coat. Gloves represent elegance. And another little symbol to look out for is an armillary sphere, which is a celestial globe. And they represent the study of the movements of the planets, and it also represents wisdom. And it could be a symbol of a good relationship between Elizabeth and her courtiers. Her mother, Anne Boleyn, had drawn a sphere in her Book of Hours. So it's a common interpretation of the sphere is to refer to the passing of time and the quality of constancy. So there's a good few ideas that people can look out for.
Wow, there is. I mean, that is a rich territory indeed. There's plenty for us to go on. pick up on a couple of little things. First of all, this may be an obvious question, but it occurred to me, so I'll ask it anyway. Why was purity so important for Elizabeth? Was it important for a queen, full stop, or was it particularly important for Elizabeth?
Both. It would be very important for any queen to be virtuous, absolutely virtuous. But in Elizabeth's case, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? Because she's celebrating her virginity. Purity was therefore essential. It's constantly been debated about Elizabeth, even at the time. The King of France said the great question was whether the Queen of England was a maid or no. And people have been debating it ever since. And I think that the answer to the question is that Elizabeth was almost certainly a virgin, that she wouldn't have risked her throne. And also she was surrounded by people, by her ladies. So I think she was a virgin. I think it became an essential part of her queenship. And also by emphasising the purity, it fed into this cult, the idea of Elizabeth as more than an ordinary woman, you know, a god, something apart.
I'm going to come on to that very, very shortly, but just to give another little bit of personal musing on this, it just occurred to me that, you know, obviously the role of a medieval or a Tudor queen was to be fertile and produce children. So in some regards, it's always puzzled me that being seen as a virgin was so lauded in somebody whose primary function was to produce an heir. But that's Elizabeth all over, isn't it? She turns something that could have been a weakness into a virtue. She kind of turns it on its head and exaggerates it to the point where she becomes like elevated as this kind of goddess almost.
Yes, yeah. So rather than it being a failing, it becomes, instead, she makes it an advantage. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think any historian who writes about Elizabeth, you do end up feeling in awe of her clever.
Yes.
Elizabeth was exceptional. You know, she's a young woman, 25 years old, coming to the throne, a huge task ahead of her. And the biggest obstacle in her way is her gender. And the only way to get around that is to be different from other women, to take the place of the Virgin Mary, as we've said. And so I think she probably didn't want to have children anyway, and for various reasons. So she's going to use this, which would be seen as a great failing. She was the first monarch in something like, I think it was 500 years actually, who didn't try to produce an heir.
Right.
That's really, significant that she's not even trying.
Yeah. No, really, really good point. So let's dive into this image of the Virgin Queen, because as I said, it's something that really interests me where and kind of why it took root. Now, maybe we've answered the question why it took root, what Elizabeth was trying to do here. Yeah. I'd love to know whether this was, you know, she kind of took herself off and sat down in a quiet corner of a quiet room and thought, what can I do here that's going to change this, you know, as I say, this kind of Achilles heel into something that people are going to end up venerating? Or did it just emerge almost by chance? I'd love to know how deliberate this image that she created was, and whether it was all Elizabeth's or whether she was inspired by somebody else.
Ooh, I don't know about being inspired. Certainly what had happened to other people would have put her off. So for example, her personal reasons for not wanting to marry, clearly events from her childhood could have put her off. And then fear of childbirth, which I think she was afraid of childbirth. Her grandmother and two of her stepmothers had died giving birth. But apart from all these personal reasons, it's the political reasons that are more compelling rather than anything psychological or physical. She had the example of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her sister, Mary Tudor, about how a match with a European prince can cause so much problems. Even marrying a nobleman can cause problems. Her council were divided on the matter, so they would entreat her to find a husband, but then they would never agree on anyone suitable. So it wasn't all just Elizabeth. But I think what we have to always remember is that in the 16th century, a husband was deemed to have authority over his wife. Marriage would likely bring some erosion of her power, which she didn't want to lose. Now, she must have thought about it very early on. It wasn't just because she couldn't marry Robert Dudley. And after Amy Robsart dies in 1560 and there's that scandal, then it becomes obvious then that, you know, she can't marry the man who she undoubtedly did love and was incredibly attracted to. Mm. But she'd obviously decided before then, because in 1559, she makes that famous speech to Parliament in which she says, This shall be for me sufficient that a marble stone shall declare that a queen, having reigned such a time, lived and died a virgin. And this is at a time, you know, when she's, 26? Mm. So it's very, very early.
Mm. Yeah.
But that could be tied up with her religious settlement, which was very important to the queen, this new, her Church of England, which would be a hybrid of Protestant liturgy and Catholic tradition that people could buy into. And she's setting out, I think quite deliberately, to take the place of the Virgin Mary. So I would say, in my view, that it is tied up with this religious settlement, and it's not just, you know, to be honest, it's probably a whole lot of reasons. And then that's how it emerges. Yeah.
I can buy that, actually, that there's a number of different threads to this tapestry. Yeah. And they came together in maybe one moment of clarity of this is how I want to be seen, but probably many influences and many events that shape that.
This is how I think it was vital for her to be seen to be unlike other women. And one way to do that is to be seen as some kind of goddess, you know, and also to be the unobtainable lady of courtly love, who would be seen to be very pure and put on a pedestal, which she certainly became. What we can be sure about is that it wasn't anything to do with not being attracted to men, because she certainly was. And she just reveled in the flattery of men. And there's a whole, you know, load of them, not just Dudley, but Christopher Hatton and Walter Raleigh, the Earl of Essex, all these men. And then there's the eminent suitors in Europe. So she also uses it as a political tool. So she's encouraging Philip of Spain, Eric of Sweden, later the Duke of Anjou, and using it as a deliberate policy for negotiations. And she loves blending romance with diplomacy. And this marriage game. And I think she really enjoyed the marriage game.
Hmm.
So she's certainly using it to her advantage.
Hmm. I'd love to know from you, which a couple of your favourite images of Elizabeth. I'll just share one of mine, since we're, let's share. So one of my favourites is one I came across in a London, it actually was sold privately, so it's in a private collection. And it's Elizabeth, certainly before the Virgin Queen persona, and she has a beautiful, rich red gown. And she just looks just like a normal woman, which you can't often see so many of those pictures when you see her later with the whole, you know, virgin mask on.
Yeah.
You lose that sort of intimacy. This is really the person to me, and yeah. I love that image for that. What about you? What are some of your favourite images of Elizabeth?
So one of my favourite images is the Darnley portrait, which is in the National Portrait Gallery. And I think that's also showing us the real Elizabeth. It's showing us her power, her composure. It's a very accomplished work, probably done by a visiting foreign painter. It's unlikely that anyone in England would have been able to produce it. And it's painted around 1575. It's thought to be the last time she's actually sat for a painting. It's showing Elizabeth dressed actually as an aristocrat in a doublet style gown with a lace ruff collar and pearls and holding an ostrich feather fan. And it's definitely lifelike. The resulting face pattern from the Darnley portrait was the pattern that was used for many years afterwards. So we can be sure that Elizabeth liked the image. Mm. But conservation work reveals that the red pigment in the flesh tones have actually faded, giving her a paler appearance. So this was actually much more lifelike, although now her face looks quite white when you look at it, but it was once rosier and more natural.
Mm.
In this painting, you can see the crown and the sceptre on the table beside her. First time they're being seen as props, actually, rather than being worn in Tudor portraiture. And whoever commissioned the work, and it's probably a courtier, probably gave her the fan that she's holding. Now, I did allude to that earlier, about how they like to, patrons like to show, have the Queen presented showing, wearing or holding a gift that they had presented to her. And it's also, she also has a pendant showing Roman gods, such as Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, renowned for promoting peace. So there's plenty of messages there in that painting. And I think that's a very good example of her portraiture. Interestingly, that particular dress from the Darnley portrait was recreated in 1971 for the BBC Elizabeth R.
So
Glenda Jackson wore it, yeah.
So people can see, you said the painting's in the National Portrait Gallery when it reopens, so people would be able to see it there, and then maybe they can tune, you know, they can go and search back through online libraries to see the dress in action.
you can see Glenda Jackson wearing it. And by the way, it's called the Darnley Portrait. It's nothing to do with Lord Darnley. It was just Earls of Darnley who used to own it. That's why it's got that name.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. Thanks for clarifying that one for us. Now, you know, most of the paintings we've been talking about are the big oil paintings. They pack a punch, but Elizabeth was often captured in miniatures. And people who listen to this podcast regularly know that I've developed a love of miniatures since talking several times to Emma Rutherford from the Philip Mould Gallery. And again, folks, maybe I'll also put a link to the miniatures podcast if you're interested and you haven't yet heard it. But Hilliard, of course, was a famous miniaturist. Now, you talk about him in the book, don't you? What a fascinating life. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of Elizabeth and miniatures and a little bit about Hilliard's life?
Yeah, well, the reason that miniatures became so important in Elizabethan England was Hilliard, because he was a genius. And it is all rather strange. He was born in Exeter, so he came from Devon, into a family of goldsmiths who incidentally enjoyed a higher status and earned more than artists. So he trained first as a goldsmith, and he would have earned more money if he stayed a goldsmith. Hilliard would later lament that paintings were a low-cost item. And he said that due to patrons who refused to pay a decent price for a picture, painting was a profession that made poor men poorer. So he probably came across miniatures during his training because the pictures were enclosed in gold settings. But it's a complete mystery how, by 1571, he'd managed to become such a talented painter. I'm afraid we don't know who taught him. He claimed himself that he said he taught himself by copying the works of Durer, because Hilliard wrote a book, The Art of Limning being their word for miniatures. But given the quality of his work, I think art historians tend to be a bit sceptical about this, that he taught himself. So maybe someone else, maybe Lavina Teerlink, John Betts the Elder, or Lucas de Heer, it's likely that someone did teach him. But by the age of 24, he says, first I came in Her Highness' presence to draw. So he's very young when he's changed from being a goldsmith to a painter, and he's actually been introduced to the Queen. That introduction came through Robert Dudley. So he was really lucky to have that connection. The greatest patron in Elizabethan England, who introduces him to the Queen. Mm. And then he goes on to have a very successful career. But he seems to have always lived beyond his means. He had a large family, and he was also dressing to present himself like the high-ranking courtiers, and had money problems all his life, I'm afraid. And actually, despite his enormous success, he died in poverty.
It's quite a common, it seems to be quite a common theme, this, for artists. They kind of die in obscurity of that time. And that's so sad, isn't it?
Well, not in obscurity, because he was recognised, as, you know, they knew that he was a great painter, and his reputation went beyond England. You know, he was recognised as the greatest miniaturist in Europe as well. And he did carry on after Elizabeth's death. You know, he had Jacobean patrons, but it wasn't quite the same. The work wasn't quite as lucrative as the Elizabethans. And he also painted in great as well as in little. So in little means miniatures, and he in great. But as Hilliard said himself, painting was not a profession that made men rich.
and he is buried in London, isn't he? I think I remember reading.
Yes, yeah. I'm afraid I can't think off the top of my head exactly where he is, but
yes, I think I remember reading in your book he was buried in London in one of the many churches in London, but I don't think he has a, you know, there's no identifiable grave, because as you said, he died in poverty, so we can't actually go and, so I don't think we can go and see where he's buried.
No, but what we do have is the paintings, and there's around 200 miniatures surviving, which is, you know,
fantastic.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. So we're coming towards the end of our chat. I always like to give people pointers about where they can go to see some of these amazing paintings, Elizabeth in oil paintings and in miniature. So where would you point us towards if we wanted to go and see some of the very best?
Windsor Castle have got Elizabeth as princess, so that's a very famous painting of Elizabeth in that rich red gown, painted shortly before her father's death. And then, but the best place, I'd say, is the National Portrait Gallery, because if you go there, you can see the coronation portrait of Elizabeth, the Darnley portrait, the Phoenix portrait, the Armada, and also the Ditchley. So you get to see her through all these different stages of her life. You can also, in the National Portrait Gallery, of course, see Mary Queen of Scots, Robert Dudley, Philip Sidney, people like Walsingham, and even Shakespeare. So really, that is the best place to go. Hatfield House have got the Rainbow and the Ermine portraits. The Rainbow portrait, I would say, is visually the most stunning. And it's so beautiful and not to be missed. V&A for miniatures. There's a miniature of Elizabeth playing the lute at Berkeley Castle. So there are a few miniatures sort of dotted around. But to see most of the miniatures, I would say the Victoria and Albert.
So just to go back to the National Portrait Gallery, if you haven't been to the Tudors Gallery there, it just blows your mind when you first walk in. You're just like surrounded by all these amazing paintings. And as I mentioned before, they have been closed, but I believe they are reopening. Is it next year, Siobhan? Do you know?
I'm afraid I don't know the exact.
No, I've got a feeling it is. I was reading it recently. I must admit, I thought it was longer than that, because I think they closed. I thought they closed for 3 to 5 years, but goodness knows, with COVID, time has just slipped away, and we might be at the end of that period. I'm looking forward to seeing what they've done.
Oh, it'll be amazing. Well, they've been on tour, haven't they? I know the painting
they have.
Born in Bath, and the very famous cartoon of Henry VIII from Holbein's mural. That people can see that in the National Gallery.
Mm. Yes, so, and I think there's also there has been. I'm not quite sure when this will be airing, but I know that there has been or is currently a big Tudors exhibition in Liverpool as well. Which I wonder what imagery is up there.
I know. Yeah, I did hear about that. Certainly, it was current. Certainly, last month. I don't know if it's still open, but yeah, there was a lot in Liverpool.
Yes, so I'll have a quick look and see if that's when this goes out. And if it's still on, folks, I'll put a link in the description below in case you are in that neck of the country and you want to go and have a look at that. But that brings us to your book. So when is this book out? When can we enjoy it and go and buy it for ourselves, Siobhan?
So it's published in the UK on the 16th of June and it will be available in bookshops and online. The US publication date is 1st of January 2023, but it is possible for people in the US to order it from the UK.
Right. And where all good bookshops online as per usual?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Excellent. Lovely. Well, with that, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to come and talk to us. It's been lovely to dive into the world of Elizabeth and portraiture.
Oh, it's pleasure.
Good luck with the book, and I'm sure I'm going to be seeing you again for the next one.
I hope so. Thank you.
Do you have anything up your sleeve for the next project, Siobhan?
No, we're taking a break now.
I can understand that. I really can. Well, enjoy a very well-earned break. And as I said, listeners, all the links we've been talking about, I will include them in the description associated with this podcast. But thanks for that, Siobhan, and I'll see you around the Tudor Sphere.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, that's a big hearty thank you to Siobhan for joining us today and telling us all about how Elizabeth cultivated the image of the Virgin Queen. I'd also like to thank Siobhan and Linda and the History Press, who are responsible for publishing Gloriana, Elizabeth I and the Art of Queenship, for sponsoring a copy to be given away as a gift to one of my patrons this month. So if you are a patron sponsoring the programme at over $5 a month, then you will be in for a chance to receive a signed copy of the book. And I'll be announcing the lucky recipient of that, of course, at the end of July, as always with the patron programme. Okay, well, I think that's all for this particular episode. I do hope you've enjoyed it. And of course, I will return again in August, at the beginning of August, with another On Location episode. And this time, I am travelling to the Weald and Downland Museum in Sussex to talk about the houses of ordinary Tudors. It's a great episode if you want to find out more about how the everyday Tudor lived and what their houses were like and how they were used. I do hope sure you'll join us because our guide is an extremely knowledgeable expert on the subject. Okay, well, until then, I wish you, wherever you are in the world, a wonderful few weeks. I hope you're enjoying your summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. And I hope for those of you in the Southern Hemisphere, it's not too cold. So I'll see you again very shortly around the Tudor Sphere. Bye for now. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, it's happy time travelling!